Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking to somebody in Canada, in McMaster University, which is Hamilton, just a little bit to the left on the map from Toronto. He's Professor Stephen Collins. He's a professor in the Department of Medicine at McMaster University. So, Stephen Collins, McMaster University, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's going to be very interesting to get into the actual topic for which you're sort of really making the rounds these days. But before we get into that, the audience likes to know a little bit about the guest. How did you become a scientist in the medical profession?
Well, I first became a physician. Nobody in my family was in medicine. My father wanted to be a physician, but his career plans got messed up by the war. And I think he always had an expectation that his only son should be a physician, and I didn't have any problem with that. So I went to medical school. I was fortunate to get into one of the London medical schools. I lived in downtown London, and I got in.
That's London, England, just for
London,
the listener.
England, yeah. Right. Yeah, so I was raised in London, in a part of London called Battersea, which is not far from the centre of London, the Houses of Parliament and so forth. And I was fortunate enough to get into medical school at University College in London and to do my clinical training at the Westminster Hospital, which has since become amalgamated with St Thomas's. And I had an excellent education in medicine. In those days in Britain, particularly if you were in either Oxford, Cambridge, Edinburgh, or the London teaching hospitals, the goal was to be a consultant in one of the specialties. And in order to do that, you had to have some achievement in research, and the competition was fierce. It was a very steep pyramidal system in Britain in those days, probably still is. And everybody worked extremely hard to try to get the attention of their superiors and then to get promoted up through the ranks and eventually become consultants. And so I was at a fairly young stage when I saw all this happening, and I was impressed by people doing research and the sorts of the energies they had, albeit the fact that in Britain at the time, for physicians, research was often a means to an end, which is something I'll come back to later. Anyway, I caught the research bug, if you will, at a fairly early stage in my medical career. So I got my training, and then I did my postgraduate training in medicine in Britain, in London, and then in Leicester. And I was enjoying it, but I didn't do much research because I was busy getting my specialist certifications in medicine. Around that time, my family decided to emigrate to Canada. This would have been in the late 60s, early 70s. And being single and living in London in those heady times with the Beatles and everything else, I couldn't for the life of me understand why I should want to emigrate. I held off for a few years. But eventually in 75, I promised them I would give it a try. And so the professor that I worked for in Britain had very strong connections with a new medical school that was being established in Canada, McMaster University. And McMaster University at the time was an established university, but had just built its medical school with a very innovative curriculum. And it was staffed almost exclusively by consultants from Britain and from a particular hospital called the Hammersmith Hospital, which was the main postgraduate hospital. So coming to McMaster from Britain was like coming home from home.
Right.
It was very hard to find a North American accent. And I was very much at home here, and I continued my clinical training.
And the rest is history. Just tell us very briefly, tell the audience, how it is that, you know, in England, in Britain, you could go straight from grammar school, or high school as they would call it here, to medical school. I mean, you could start training at a very young age. You didn't have to go through this tedious process of getting a degree in chemistry or biological sciences.
Right. No, that was the norm. That was the
exactly.
norm for everybody I knew. If you wanted to go to medical school, you had to start thinking about it when you were about 15 or 16. You talked to the career guidance people at the school. You kind of knew there were basically three different levels of medical school. There was Oxford, Cambridge, the London teaching hospitals, and Edinburgh, and then there were the so-called red brick universities. And depending on your connections, depending on whatever personal attributes you had,
right,
and your academic performance, you had to kind of gauge which of those you were going to shoot for.
Just remind me, I grew up at about the same time as you, just a little earlier perhaps. But I remember very much the Oxford-Cambridge business was predicated, in my case, not going there, because I just rebelled against Latin. I spent most of the Latin classes outside the room. We had an Irish master, Mr. Kelly, and towards the end of the period of time when I was studying Latin, he'd come in and say, "Well, panel, you better get outside straight away." And so my Latin was a disaster. Did you have to have Latin if you wanted to go to Cambridge for medical school?
To get into the pre-med, which is Oxford and Cambridge, I'm not sure that you had to be well-rounded. You had to have very high scores.
Right.
You probably did have to have Latin.
Yeah.
I certainly had Latin. I actually enjoyed Latin.
I wish I had, but
and,
I didn't.
Latin and history were my, and math were my strengths.
Oh, right.
The rest of it wasn't. But, yeah, so I didn't see myself getting into to Oxford or Cambridge, but I did apply to the London schools, and I recall being phoned and having my first interview when I was just over 15 years of age. I think it was the first time I shaved.
You shaved for a phone interview?
Oh, no, I shaved for a real interview, and I remember it very, very clearly. These guys sitting around a table, and I walked in there, and the first question I was asked by this consultant was, he asked me, where was the sports page in the Manchester Guardian newspaper?
And you were lucky enough to say towards the back, or?
No, because the guy in the Guardian, it was different. It was in the middle.
Ah, right.
All the other papers had it on the back. And
oh, it was a very nice question.
So he asked me that. I only fell on the floor. I had no idea. Anyway, and I was a soccer player, and I was on the track team, and that seemed to be the focus of the discussion.
Yeah.
And they wanted to know whether I'd be prepared to play on the wing if I came to that medical school. They wanted to know my 100 yards and 220 yard times.
Times have changed, Stephen Collins, haven't they?
That's really what the whole thing was about.
Okay.
And then the last question was, why do you want to be a physician? And so on. So anyway, I was lucky enough to get into the Westminster, and their preclinical school was University College.
So let's jump into what it is that you're doing these days. I mean, the expression I used at the beginning on one of your websites, the enteric nerve and muscle function.
Yeah.
What does that mean, and how does that lead into this wonderful work that you'll be doing with bacteria?
Sure. Well, I have to take a step back. So I completed my clinical training at McMaster in gastroenterology, and then I decided that research was for me. And so I applied for a research fellowship at the National Institutes of Health in the digestive diseases branch, and to my amazement, I got in, and I spent 3 years down there learning cell biology. And I came back to McMaster to a faculty position. And I was regarded as the sort of rat doctor because I'd spent 3 years dealing with mice and rats and guinea pigs and what have you, and I didn't really have a niche. And so all of my colleagues had captured various clinical practices. Somebody was the czar in ulcer disease. Somebody else was doing whatever, whatever. And so I was left with the patients that nobody else wanted to see, which were patients who had what's called irritable bowel. And irritable bowel syndrome is a syndrome where the bowel is structurally normal but functionally abnormal. And
You had no choice in this?
No.
Okay, go on.
Because I was the junior guy,
right.
And I was a kind of distracted rat doctor, and we'll just give him all these patients. So that's why. And I couldn't handle it. I didn't know what to do with these patients. I certainly heard their stories, but there really wasn't a good appreciation as to what was wrong with them. And in those days, because a lot of these patients have, you know, what's referred to as psychiatric comorbidity. In other words, they may be a little bit neurotic, they may be anxious or depressed and so forth with their GI symptoms. And some of them had reason to be because nobody was taking their symptoms terribly seriously. So I was faced with this. I didn't know where to start. And so I decided I should focus my research on this particular group of patients. So I started off by doing studies on motility, how the bowel moves, because that at the time was thought to be a contributing factor to symptom generation in these patients. And I became rapidly disenchanted with that, because measuring these squiggly little lines and patterns of how the bowel moved was way too descriptive. And even though you could see changes, the question for me was, why are there changes? And so that led me to sort of think a little bit more deeply about this condition. And I was always struck by the similarity with a condition in the lung called asthma. And asthma is a condition in the lung where the lung is, you know, from a 2 yards back, structurally normal, and yet the function of the airways is totally abnormal. It goes into spasm and you get asthma. And it seemed to me that this was pretty much what goes on in irritable bowel.
And that hadn't been observed, or there was nothing in the literature to suggest that.
Oh, no.
So this was a creative moment.
This was one of those moments where, and I remember very vividly being at a meeting and getting up and giving a talk to say that I believe that irritable bowel is the asthma of the gut. And I actually published a paper back in, I don't know, a long time ago, saying this. And I remember at the meeting, and I was laughed out of the room because the guy who got up after me said, I think the previous speaker was deluded. I think he was referring, because at that time it became evident, that asthma was actually an inflammatory condition, because they discovered that these patients who have asthma, if you pull out the fluid in their lungs, you could pick out these inflammatory cells, because the lungs are pretty sterile, relatively sterile place compared to the gut.
Mm-hmm.
So it was easy to make that call, and it was a eureka moment. And overnight, it changed the perception of asthma from what used to be a psychosomatic condition to a pharmacological problem of abnormal responsiveness of muscle, twitchy muscle,
okay,
to an inflammatory condition. And now all of the therapies that have worked so well in asthmatics are all based on that. And I thought to myself, well, why can't an irritable bowel be that? We know that the muscle doesn't work well. We know that the nerves aren't coordinating properly, but something has to be driving this. So I came up with the idea that there was low-grade inflammation in the gut. And I started to do animal experiments to try to create this scenario, that is to say, inducing very, very mild inflammation, non-destructive tissue inflammation in the gut, and observing that the muscle and the nerve function would change dramatically, which it did.
Okay, we have to take a break there, Stephen. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. We're talking to Stephen Collins, Professor of Medicine at McMaster University. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. I aim for 7 hours of sleep every night, but it's more like 6 if I'm lucky.
I'm getting to bed on time, but can't fall asleep as quickly as I used to. A recent poll revealed 60% of American adults experience insomnia a few nights a week.
Unfortunately, they're not just suffering bad TV. Studies show people who sleep less than 6 hours a night died earlier than those who got a full 7 hours. My wife tells me to exercise more, hoping it'll help.
That's an interesting thought. Is there a connection between sleep and sweat? Evidence does show exercise improves sleep, but new studies reveal not in the way we thought.
In a study of women with insomnia, half the group was inactive, while the other half did 30 minutes of moderate workout several times a week. After 4 months, as expected, those in the active group slept 45 minutes to an hour longer each night, woke less often, and felt more energized.
But the scientists were surprised to find in these women's journal entries no changes in sleep 2 months into the study. It took a full 4 months for their sleep to improve, much longer than expected.
Ironically, they also did not report sleeping better on the days they exercised. Instead, they noted a good night's sleep helped them exercise better the next day, which suggests sleep may influence exercise more than the other way around.
It's possible people with sleep disorders have different brain wiring. Their stress system is hyper-aroused and requires a prolonged exercise regimen to overcome. But you can do something about your insomnia now. Improve your sleep by avoiding caffeine in the 8 hours before bed and try to get to bed at the same time every night.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Dr. Stephen Collins, Department of Medicine, McMaster University, and we're talking about some of the eureka moments, or a eureka moment, that Dr. Collins had when he understood that perhaps asthma and irritable bowel syndrome were very related, but clearly that's led you onto a lot of insights.
Yeah, so I got a lot of negative press. I got people would listen to me and say, well, you know, I don't know about that, and so I had to go into animal models to provide proof of concept that if you induced low-grade inflammation, you could actually change, and quite extensively change, the function of nerve and muscle and develop a scenario that's similar to irritable bowel. I also showed then that once the inflammation had subsided, that the bowel, that the muscle and the nerve, the function of those tissues didn't actually return to normal always. And so it seemed to me plausible then that low-grade inflammation could be a mechanism in irritable bowel. But just to deal with my critics, we did do a study where we took patients with irritable bowel and we measured their airway responsiveness, the twitchiness of their airways, and we found it to be similar to asthma, even though they weren't declaring asthmatic symptoms. And so,
that's quite an amazing result, right?
Yeah, so that was published, and it was a paper that drew a lot of attention and so forth. And what we thought at the time, there were two possibilities. One was we excluded patients who had allergies, because obviously allergy can affect different parts of the body. But basically, that there was a shared pathophysiology, and the shared pathophysiology could be one of two things. It could be because their body's rheostats, if you will, was set at a slightly different, higher level so that low-grade inflammation was permitted. And this reflected in terms of airway responsiveness and the gut. The other was because they're both innervated by the brain, by the autonomic nervous system, that perhaps there was a central component and that autonomic outflow from the brain was affecting these hollow organs in the same way.
Okay.
But I regained some credibility at that point.
And, and your father was very happy?
Yeah, he was happy about that. And then I started to continue with the animal models and then started to collaborate with groups that were interested in gastroenteritis. And in particular, with a group in Sheffield where I had a friend and colleague, and they were following a group of individuals who suffered from food poisoning in Sheffield, and they found that this group went on to develop irritable bowel. So Not totally surprising, exactly. So this sort of really was consistent with what I've been showing in the animal models. And so we worked together and we showed in those patients that the people who got food poisoning and went on to get irritable bowel syndrome had a different immunological and inflammatory response to the initial infection. They didn't downregulate the inflammatory response to the infection in an efficient way. And as a result, the inflammatory process lingered. And my opinion was that this lingering inflammation, mild as it was sufficient to produce tissue dysfunction. And this has now become a condition that's well accepted. It's called post-infectious irritable bowel. It's a component, one of the irritable bowel subsets. A few years later, and I'm just jumping ahead a bit here, there's a town nearby Hamilton where I work, where the water supply to the town became contaminated after a heavy rainfall in the spring of 2000, where 2,000 people in the town over a holiday weekend got severely infected by a whole cocktail of bugs because, as I said, the heavy rain swept manure into the reservoir system. And we were able to study those patients, and we published 6 or 7 papers. to show that there is a very definite risk if you get an acute infection that you'll go on to develop irritable bowel syndrome. Our figures are around 27% of those. And we did genomic studies and showed that the people who went on to get this condition had genetic abnormalities in areas of the genome that encode for bacterial recognition and for the inflammatory response to bacteria. So, you know, it was all beginning to come together.
Come together, right.
Right. So the other thing that we found in this group of patients is that if you get an irritable bowel syndrome after an enteric infection, it's not just a short-lived reaction. It can actually go on and become chronic. And we found that patients 8 years or longer after the infection were still highly symptomatic. So that posed a different question. So it's easy to understand, okay, you're unlucky enough to get a bacterial or a viral infection. You don't, you know, you down-regulate your inflammatory response in an inefficient manner, but slowly the system would recover. And we're now confronted with the idea, well, no, this takes a long time to recover if it's going to recover. So there must be something else that is maintaining the dysfunction. And that's when my attention turned to the intestinal microbiota, or the intestinal microbiome, which is, you know, the millions, trillions of bacteria that live in the bowel. Now, unfortunately, in that study in this town, the town was called Walkerton. It's quite famous now for the because of all of this. We didn't have the nous at the time to take stool samples and bring them 100 kilometers down here and do these studies to actually ask the question. But in retrospect, that's what we should have done. But still, it then enabled us to ask questions about the role of the microbiome in the expression of irritable bowel syndrome. And the thinking then was, well, if something happens to you that results in a perturbation of the bacterial composition of your bowel, can that result in changes that are reminiscent of what we see in irritable bowel syndrome? So then we went back to our animal models and we asked a number of questions. And so the first question was, If you take a healthy animal with a stable, healthy microbiome and you perturb it, transiently perturb it, and we chose to use a mild cocktail of antibiotics just to shift the composition a little bit, the relative abundances, the distribution of the different bacterial families, and observe what impact that had. And what we found was that, for example, if you did that, you could dramatically change the threshold for pain perception in the bowel, which is a classic feature of irritable bowel.
So just by giving a small cocktail of antibiotics?
By giving a small cocktail of antibiotics,
right,
that didn't wipe out your bacteria, but simply changed the composition.
Yeah, relative populations of one bacterium compared to another.
Absolutely. And we found that that was sufficient to cause a substantial reduction in the threshold at which animals perceive visceral gut pain.
That of course, you could argue that that meant that that particular grouping of bacteria that you'd got rid of, in a sense, was the responsible culprit.
Yeah. That was what we did. We also saw in these animals that their behavior changed. And we were quite perplexed about this, you know, because the technicians or the students would come back up and say, these animals that had the antibiotics, they're not behaving. I mean, it's weird. They just seem to be different. So we then did a formal evaluation using standard psychometric testing to see whether or not the behavior in these animals was indeed abnormal in a reproducible way, and it was. And we then took the brains from these mice and studied the chemistry in the brain, and we found that during antibiotic treatment that certain chemicals, one in particular, which was a chemical called brain-derived neurotrophic factor in the hippocampus, was markedly reduced, and that after the antibiotics were stopped, about 3 weeks later, the behavior and the brain chemistry reverted to normal, as did the bacterial composition of the gut.
So this was a temporary feature.
Yes.
So the equilibrium of all the different bacteria reestablished, in a sense.
It did.
Okay.
And that's exactly what happens in man and in healthy individuals.
So what about people who take antibiotics almost permanently?
Yeah, I don't think they've been studied, but yeah. One wouldn't be surprised if there was a change in behavior.
I remember I went to India once, and it was for about 6 or 7 weeks on something called Cipro.
Yeah.
I don't know if my brain function changed, but I didn't get sick. That was the big deal.
That's the main thing.
Right.
So anyway, that's what we did. And then we had to sort of do some confirmatory studies. We had to prove that it wasn't the antibiotic itself that was changing behavior.
Right.
And we proved that.
And how do you do that? You just sort of take a biome from one animal and put it into another?
What we did subsequently. But to answer the antibiotic question, what we did was we gave the antibiotics not by mouth, but into the system. We bypassed the gut, gave it straight, and we found that it couldn't change behavior. So that was how we did that.
That's clever.
And then we did exactly what you've just said. We said, well, if this is true, it means that the microbial composition of the gut is one of probably several determinants of behavior. So what we did was then to take different strains of laboratory mice. And laboratory mice strains are pretty much like humans. You know, you get good guys and you get not so good guys. And you get one strain of mouse that's extremely calm and well-behaved, and you get another strain of mouse that's pretty nasty and jumping around all over the place, pretty aggressive. And we asked the question, if we raise these mice germ-free, could we change what we believe to be their genetically determined behavior by altering, giving them a completely different microbiome? And we did. And so we took bugs from a calm mouse and shoved it into germ-free mice who were...
Very clinical. You shoved it in. Right. Yeah. I like it.
I'm a gastroenterologist, right? we're usually shoving stuff in.
Right.
So and we were able to change it in either direction. So what we showed in the animal studies was that the microbiome can not only influence gut function, but can also influence brain and behavior. And then coming back to irritable bowel syndrome, which is where I started off, as I'd mentioned, the research in this area had been prejudiced by the fact that so many of these patients exhibit neurotic behavior and had gotten a label of a psychosomatic illness. So given our animal work, we figured that, well, the microbiome, if it's altered in these patients, could actually account for both the gut dysfunction as well as contribute, perhaps, to the behavioral abnormalities that these patients so often exhibit. So to examine that, our current research asks the question, is the microbiome in irritable bowel patients functionally abnormal? To do this, what we do is we take stool from healthy subjects and from irritable bowel patients, and we put them into germ-free mice to see whether we can create the IBS phenotype. And our data now show that when we do that, if we take a germ-free mouse and colonize it with bacteria from healthy individuals, not much happens. If we do it from IBS individuals, we can produce changes in both the gut and the brain to suggest that the microbiota of IBS patients is not only abnormal in terms of its structure, but it confers different functions in the host. So at the moment, that's where we're going. We're about to publish that work, and it's sort of, I think, heading towards a confirmatory role that the microbiota is very important in irritable bowel syndrome.
And in, therefore, in behavior, too, in the end.
Yeah, right. So people are now extrapolating and saying, well, what about primary behavioral conditions such as anxiety, depression, autism, schizophrenia? And those studies are ongoing in different groups, including ours.
Right. Stephen Collins, Professor of Medicine at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Thank you so much for being on Science Studio. Norma Martinez, thank you for putting this program together, as usual. And to the listener, thank you very much for being out there, because if there's no listener, there's no program. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Vodafone America's Foundation has announced its annual Wireless Innovation Prize. Up to $300,000 will be awarded for mobile or wireless solutions that have the potential to solve issues in fields such as health or education. Deadline to apply is February 3rd. Learn more at the region's Life Sciences News Digest. Go to mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse comes from Sierra Providence Health Network.